Good afternoon and welcome back. Hope you all enjoyed your lunch.
Yeah.
Oh, good. And the exhibits. I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Stephen Kravitz for session 112, The Effects of Aging and Diabetes on Skin, Understanding Skin as an Organ and Improving Skin Health. Dr. Stephen Kravitz is Executive Director and Founder of the American Professional Wound Care Association. He's Assistant Professor of Department of Podiatric Medicine and Orthopedics at Temple University School of Podiatric Medicine. He's on the editorial board of Advances in Skin and Wound Care Journal, publication published by Lippincott Williams and Wilkins. He's also certified by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery, the American Board of Podiatric Orthopedics and Primary Podiatric Medicine. He's a fellow of the American Professional Wound Care Association and the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons and the American College of Foot and Ankle Orthopedics and Medicine. He's on multiple peer review panels for articles, and he has spoken internationally and nationally. Let's please welcome Dr. Stephen Kravitz.
Thank you very much. It's always nice to have the applause before you speak, so I thank you for welcoming me here. It's a pleasure to be at this meeting. I think it's our eighth or ninth year at this conference, and the American Professional Wound Care Association, I'm proud to say, has a fair amount of faculty members presenting this year. This lecture is one of my favorite lectures. There's a new version we just are working on, which hopefully maybe next year we'll share with you, but this is the second version of this mission I've taken on in my professional career of trying to get us in medicine on the same page on language with science, and also trying to get us in medicine to understand soft tissue injuries better, and particularly to wound care, paying more attention to the skin as an organ. The preface to this talk is the following. When I go, and once in a while, as executive director of the Wound Care Association, I do attend a conference on cardiovascular disease or other similar disease pathology. At a cardiovascular meeting, one has lectures on the myocardial infarct. In our domain, the infarct is a hole in the skin. It's sort of corollary. At vascular meetings, cardiovascular meetings, though, they also have lectures on the heart as an organ. What makes the heart healthy or unhealthy? What increases and decreases risk? And looking at the heart as a true organ system, wound care meetings don't do that. Wound care meetings look at the infarct. We spend little time looking at the prairie wound, and we certainly don't spend enough time looking at the skin as an organ. I perceive the day, hopefully before I have to retire from this whole field, that one will have a scanner that one can look at the skin of a hand, and from that determine your skin's deficient in A, B, C, and D, because it's my perception, although I can't prove this, but I think it makes sense, looking at other tissue systems, that if the skin is healthier as an organ, it should have less ability to break down, and when it does break down, have a better rate of return and healing. And I think we need to spend more attention on dermatological aspects of wound care and not just the whole. So that's the preface of where I come from today. I am off the American Professional Wound Care Association. I invite all of you to stop by booth 717 and learn more about our organization and hopefully consider joining. And there's my ad. I also want to thank McCord Research and her friends at the University of Iowa, which have given me exclusive ability to present this type of data. And the motion pictures involved in this that they've allowed us to use exclusively through the association and through their very generous grant. Alvin Toffler, for those of my age group, you would be familiar. He is a philosopher that was extremely popular back in the 80s. And one of his quotes out of many is the following. The illiterate of the year 2000 will not be the individual who cannot read and write, but the one who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. And I'm going to share with you some principles that I've learned from this lecture presentation that heretofore I was not aware of, and today in medical schools are still teaching old school technology and it's not on page which has been shown in the past 5 or 6 years to be how cells actually work and function. The first part of fulfilling my mission is to talk about definition. And we'll talk about four terms which I think are important for us to understand wound care. One is apoptosis and senescence, and the other two are quiescence and necrosis. And this comes from the observation that I have gone to meetings, and many of you have, across the country and internationally, where speakers of well-known repute get up and say one of the common connectors between all chronic non-healing wounds is that the cells are senescent. And that's been repeated over and over again in our literature and from the podium. That statement is incorrect. It's wrong. It is wrong. Our literature is incorrect. And what happens is, because we're not scientists, a writer, an author, reads an article, reads a passage, thinks that makes sense, and restates the same thing over and over again. So let's look at what these terms mean. Apoptosis is normal cell death. Apoptosis occurs after a certain number of days. The cell goes through an aging process and then goes on to its merry yonder up in the skies in heaven and dies. Apoptosis is not part of wound care. You can't change apoptotic cells. They're going to die because of aging. Senescence is a term that's almost not being used by science anymore. But what it refers to is a cell that no longer will go through mitosis. It can't. It's stopped for whatever reason. You can't change it. So from the podium, stating that one of the things all cells, all wounds have in common is that cells are senescent and we want to change that is incorrect. The proper term that we should be using is quiescence. Quiescence in geophase means a cell stops to mitose, stops to divide due to a stressor. If you remove the stressor, the cell divides again. That stressor for us might be hyperglycemia. It might be pressure. It might be ischemia. It could be any one of these number of things. If you find out what that is and stop it, the cells will again start to divide. All non-healing complex wounds have that in common. Cells are stuck in the quiescent geophase and can't mitose. That is one of the things that we want to address in all wound care that we do. The other thing that we want to address in all wound care that we do is necrosis. Necrosis is what Dr. McCord would call, Darlene would call, cellular murder. The cell dies prematurely due to a stressor. So if wounds all have those two things in common, cells that die prematurely and cells that can't mitose, any cell that's caught in that phase of its existence will not allow a wound to heal. Wounds to heal must stop necrosis and must stop quiescence so that cells don't die prematurely and other cells divide. And if you handle those two principles in every complex wound, you get wound healing. I don't care if it's a pressure ulcer, a diabetic ulcer, a venous ulcer, or an ischemic ulcer. All of these have this in common. So this is apoptosis. This is normal cellular death. So let's look at it a little bit and see what we see here. Let me get my pointer up. Oh, don't want to go there. Pointer. Visible. Okay. So let's look at this cell going through necrosis. And you'll see this is an interesting thing. First off, as the cell starts to go through this, and you'll see this loop repeated, you'll see the first thing that happens is that the cell has multiple granules in it, grains of sand. Those granules are the mitochondria, the Golgi apparatus, the DNA of the nucleus, all coming apart. And that happens first, and then afterwards the cell wall comes apart and the cell collapses. Until the cell wall comes apart, the cell remains intact. So the cell wall is a very important aspect of cellular life. It's what keeps the cells together. The cell remains alive, even though all these internal organs are coming apart, until the cell wall collapses. So let's look at it again on this last loop before I get to the next slide. Here you see it's coming apart. Now the other thing which you can't see on this slide is the following. Necrotic cells, when they come apart, all their organelles, all their substance are absorbed by the cell surrounding them as food. So apoptosis is a normal cycle of life when cells die, their parts become nourishment for the cells surrounding them. And one last time. Here, see all the granules? There, now comes apart. Okay? So, internal destruction, the wall stays in part, then the wall begins to break down, and the cell winds up becoming destroyed. Senescence, as I mentioned, is non-reversible. You can't change it. It's not critical to wound care. And what other speakers say from the podium is incorrect. Hopefully, one day, we'll change that in our literature. Quiescent cells, not maybe, are important to skin and wound repair because they're resting. They're in the geophase, they're non-mitotic, and that can be changed. Here's a cell going through necrosis. Internal organelles come apart. The cell gradually begins to wither on its, and now, there you go. There you go. So the internal organelles come apart, the cell membrane stays intact, And then the cell dies. Necrosis is reversible. And so all wounds stop necrosis and stop quiescence. The cellular membrane is important. We have always been taught and thought that the nucleus was the control panel for the cell. The nucleus was the computer that controlled it. It's not. The cell wall is where the memory is composed that allows the cell to live from day to day and is involved with daily function and its interaction with the environment, not the nucleus. Anucleated cells ingest, metabolize food, maintain coordinated operations like respiration, digestion, excretion, communication with cells, etc. Without the outer cell membrane, there's instant necrosis. So we have to change your way of thinking. This has a very important aspect when you're talking about therapeutics. Because therapeutics now in different disease processes should target different aspects of the cell depending on what it is you're trying to deal with, whether it be an antibiotic or other aspects of the cell. The cell wall is the true brain of the cell. It is involved in daily operations. The DNA is simply not. The DNA is involved in mitosis and cellular division. The cell, the DNA not only is involved with reproduction, but it also serves as a thumb drive. Everybody, most of you should be familiar with a thumb drive, but in case you're not, I gave my thumb drive to the AV guy in the back. He owes me my thumb drive back, so I can't demonstrate it right now. But a thumb drive is a little tiny chip that you plug into your laptop or your computer, and you transmit information. We don't use disks anymore, so we don't use floppies. We now use these thumb drives, tiny little things that hold a lot of information. The nucleus is akin to that. It takes information from the environment, coordinates it, translates it into a language that's acceptable, and then transfers that to the cell wall, and the cell wall retains it. The cell wall is the aspect of the cell that controls daily activity. Cells possess functional aspects equivalent to all of us who are living bodies. They have nervous systems, digestive systems, circulatory, integument management, immune systems, all of these are represented in the cells. And so they are an analog to us as a human being in many, many ways. And they're also an analog in the community in which they live. And I find this to be philosophically fascinating. This is a specimen of live renal tissue. And it doesn't really matter where it comes from, but what you'll see here is cells going through apoptosis and dying, while cells are also going through mitosis and dividing. New birth, while other cells die, in a continuum. As long as that balance maintains an appropriate equilibrium, tissues survive and progress. When that balance is disturbed, when mitosis doesn't happen, when cells become necrotic and they die prematurely, we get disease. And that disease can be skin, it can be heart, it can be cardiac, it can be vascular disease, and it can be cancerous. All of these chronic diseases are tied in with links that relate to each other, and the basic essential of them is this community. How do cells die? Nearly apoptosis. And how do cells divide? And when they divide, do they divide properly, forming new healthy cells that propagate toward a healthy organ system? Fascinating. Community of life. So knowing all that good stuff, let's see how some of that relates more toward wound care. We've mentioned before that the cell membrane is a major aspect of cellular life, and you'll see in a few minutes that they learned that by looking at skin cells originally. That's where a lot of this information originally came from. It's fascinating. The survival of the cell membrane is to make sure that the cell interacts with its environment in a manner to obtain survival. So it survives and goes through a normal life cycle, dying and going on through apoptosis. My daughter is 12 years old, and she's taking Spanish, which is terrific. But I wish she could also take Chinese, because I think Chinese is where things go in the future for Asia, but the school system next year will offer Chinese. All right. In science, the spin now is language of cells. Epicellular language. How do cells communicate with each other? They have found in the past few years that they communicate through a language that's based on positive and negative charges. It's fascinating. They're trying to break down the alphabet with the languages, but when they break down the language, they can change how cells communicate and change how disease is transmitted. It is fascinating. Over the next 5 to 10 years, when you combine all of this with the understanding of the genotype, how that impacts on long-term prognosis, and understanding language and actually communicating with cells, the progression we will make in preventing the development of disease will be phenomenal. It is infinite as to how far we can go. Mars is one direction, the other direction is internal. And this is fascinating stuff from an internal aspect. And it's not just skin. Skin's one aspect of it. Epigenetics literally means control above genetics. Listen to this quote. Environmental influences, including nutrition and stress, can modify genes without changing their basic blueprint. And these changes can be passed on to future generations. What does that mean? To me, it means this. A family may have a sixth-generation history of prostate or breast cancer. Doesn't mean the next generation has to. Because it is now more likely that that is not part of the basic blueprint, but is part of a modification of the gene that's happened to a stressor. If they find the stressor, that stops. So what we've always thought of as genetic imprint may not be as imprinted as we thought it was. There's now hope. Some of this is related to the environment in which that cell survives. And the stress can be any one of a number of things. We talk a lot about diet. We talk a lot about nutrition. We talk a little about sleep. I believe in the next 5 to 10 years we're going to learn more and more how sleep is important as a stressor and lack of it. So it goes on and on, but can you imagine how far this goes and how much promise it gives, how much promise it gives to those looking at chronic diseases. And when we look at diabetes on the next aspect of this talk today, we'll see how this type of thought process impacts directly on diabetes and the aging of skin. So with all that good scientific, fascinating background, let's get back to some basics of cellular structure and skin structure and have some fun. As we all know, the ground substance of most cells is about 70% water, very important aspect of the cell. Only 2% is lipid, by the way. In the next few minutes, you'll learn how important lipid is to the skin. Lipid is extremely important to maintaining a skin barrier. But as far as water goes, it's also very important, 70% of the cells. We are today dehydrated. The average 150-pound male should be drinking somewhere around 2 to 3 liters of water a day. How many people in this room drink 3 liters of water a day? Raise your hands. Very, very few. So we're not only reconstipated, our cells are dehydrated. They don't have enough water in them to function properly. Now, if you look at that in our world global existence, what's one thing that all third world countries have in common are two items. One, they have disease. They have also have tremendous infertility problems, and all of them have a lack of appropriate nutrition through water. Water is very important. How can somebody prevent progression of disease, prevent progression of diabetes through immune system when the simple thing like hydration of the cell can't be maintained? And with a diabetic patient, it's not only consuming the water, it's retaining it. They're hyperuremic. So it becomes a major problem to see how do you prevent progression when the immune system's got to be tuned and the cell doesn't even have enough water for the battery to be charged properly. Simple thing like hydration. So we should all be drinking water more and being having ourselves appropriately nutritious because of that. Now, I mentioned when we first started, my whole philosophy here is looking at skin as an organ. So let's look at the peripheral skin here. This is a lateral malleolar ulcer. It's down to subcutaneous tissue. Bone's just beneath the slough. It's fairly deep, but has not affected bone yet. My point here is this. I don't care what you put on this wound here. This can't heal if that peri wound does not improve. Every cell that allows the wound to heal comes from the periphery and migrates toward the cell, the base of the wound. Nothing generates in the middle of the cell, of the wound. All comes from the periphery. That periphery cannot allow healing if this looks like this. We need more time spending attention to the periphery, and we need more time understanding it. This skin is so atopic that if you apply a 1% cortisone to try to decrease inflammation, you usually wind up with an atopic response. You can apply the cortisone out here where the skin's healthy. It won't create the atopic response, and the cortisone will automatically migrate to the area of inflammation. Inflammation will draw the cortisone. So remember that when you have an inflamed area, apply topical agents proximal and or peripheral where the skin is healthy, and you will get a good distribution to the area of inflammation because it's automatically attracted by the inflammatory reaction. Very interesting. Skin is an organ, and it will transmit to where it needs to based on where these processes occur. The skin is indeed one of the largest organs of the body. It has its own immune system. Normal skin cells have a normal life of about 4 weeks, and that's pretty much to the clock. They come off the basement membrane and slough off into the environment in about 28 days. The skin protects against environmental stress, but also protects against dehydration, and the skin barrier is extremely important in that regard. It is the largest producer of enzymes and hormones in the body, and as I mentioned in a previous slide, treatment in one area adjacent to an inflamed area can affect the area of inflammation. So remember that little pearl. So look at the structures of the skin, going back to a little bit of basic science, back to your days back in school. I'll try not to be too boring with this stuff. We have the skin broken down into three basic layers, the dermis and epidermis, and with the epidermis, it's a stratum corneum. This is a highly metabolic area, including the stratum corneum are anucleated cells without nucleus stacked on top of each other. They're flattened like a pancake. I was taught in school that these cells are dead. They're not alive. It's incorrect. And today in medical school, they still teach that. These cells are, in fact, active. They are alive. They have thousands of chemical reactions going on per minute. They communicate with each other, and they do it without a nucleus. Why? Because the nucleus controls mitosis and division. The cell wall is intact, and therefore the cell is still alive. So this is one of the areas they looked at and said, you know, when we were in school, the nucleus controlled everything, right? Now we learn that. And how could that be if these cells are alive? Can't be. So the stratum corneum, let's take a little closer look at that. It's built in what is known as a brick-and-mortar configuration, and the mortar or the sealant between these cells is mortar. So the stratum corneum, which is the outer layer of the skin barrier, is fashioned so that the seam between each of these cells is covered by a cell above it. There is no open direct portal to environment and the internal aspect of the body. You have the zigzag fashion to try to protect it. And the mortar between the cells is lipid. When we use a bar soap, any bar soap, they're extremely alkaline. And they dry the skin out. And one thing they do is pull out the lipid material. Now, if you're talking about a 2-year-old newborn, That's fine. You're fat and pudgy, and a two-year-old newborn will replace the lipid instantaneously. So ivory soap is fine. Ivory soap is not fine for us because it will dry us out. All the bar soaps are very alkaline, and so you should be using other kinds of skin cleansers. These are phospholipids, which are pH balanced. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But all bar soaps dry out skin. They remove the lipid material. In a diabetic patient, that is very, very harmful, because when the lipid material is gone, the barrier is gone, and now bacteria and fungi can get in, and they dehydrate even faster. You have an open portal for folliculitis, other types of skin infection, which can go deep. In an incense-sink patient, they can't feel it. And think about adding that aspect to the bottom of the foot when you're walking on it and they have shear. It is problematic. Now, the other interesting factor in skin that I find fascinating, at least, is the dermal-epidermal junction. This is dermis, epidermis, and stratum corneum. Remember that all the blood vessels, all the nerves are near dermis. The epidermis and stratum corneum are completely devoid of blood vessels and nerves, meaning that all nutrition, all good things have to go get into the upper two layers of skin through this junction, and all waste has to be removed through there. Because of that, there is a very aggressively structured capillary bed at the dermal-epidermal junction. There's also this configuration of retopes. Retopes, R-E-T-E-P-E-G-S, retopes are these finger-like projections that increase surface area. So as you have these projections, you get increased surface area for good things to come in, bad things to go out, and then high capillary bed. As we age, these projections flatten and become, this whole area becomes flatter. And as that happens, we lose the ability to resist shear. Because not only does this add the benefit, this structure add the benefit of allowing good things to come in and bad things to go out through nutrition, but it also locks the dermis and the epidermis to protect against shear and slippage. As that flattens, skin surfaces begin to lose interface assembly, and therefore we get skin tears. You've all seen skin tears on patients in nursing homes. They bump the anterior aspect of their tibia against a bedpost, and they get a skin tear, which is simply a shearing. Young people don't get that because the retopes are intact. The other thing that happens is that at the dermal-epidermal junction, these capillary buds can be lost. So this is an excellent slide showing how vast the capillary buds are at the dermal-epidermal. Look at this beautiful micrograph. Look at the number of capillaries here. Phenomenal. Imagine losing as much as 70% of these as we age, and with a flatter surface, so you lose surface area, and diabetes accelerates the rate at which that occurs. Diabetes accelerates the aging of skin. Duralema courts would say a 10 to 12 year history of diabetes, picture it as about a 15-year progression in skin age. Patients 50, skin age 65. Patients 65, skin age 80. Now, that's somewhat, I guess, figurative, but it gives us a good handle on how to understand the process and what to explain to patients. And patients can understand that kind of language very, very clearly. So think about the diabetic patient. We're losing the retopes. We're losing the ability to resist shear. We're losing the ability to get good nutrition in and bad things out, and capillary buds to do that. Man, oh man, oh man, it's amazing these patients don't get more plantar ulcers, and what a job we have to try to heal these ulcers and try to prevent these people from getting them. It is indeed a challenge that is monumental. So we know with all that good stuff, as we go to the next phase and then tie this all in together, that hyperglycemia prevents grafts from healing. Most skin surgeons will not do a graft when hyperglycemia levels are too high because the data is such that they can't heal the graft. Why does that happen? Where does hyperglycemia affect the skin, and how does it work? Well, one thing to keep in mind is this. Everybody has a level which, when the sugar reaches that level, the cells will stop mitosing. It's different for different people, but there's a level which cells can divide. And Mr. and Mrs. Patient, with this hole in your leg or their back or wherever it might be, if your skin cells can't divide, it doesn't matter what I do, I can't heal your wound. You have to get your blood sugars down. You have to do this, or your skin cells will not allow this to heal. You will get infected, and you can lose your leg. Hyperglycemia is very, very important. It stops proliferation of cells. It also leads to crossing of collagen and glycosylation of collagen. Now, we have known for many, many years, at least us in the podiatry field, that diabetes leads to cross-linking of collagen, because we know that patients with diabetes have stiffness of the joint capsules. They get what's called, for example, hallux limitus. The big toe doesn't bend up properly when they walk because the first MP joint becomes fibrosed because of collagen cross-linking. We've known that for years. Stiff joints on feet lead to ulcers. But we have not really looked at heretofore is the following. It's not just cross-linking of the collagen of a joint, it's also cross-linking of the collagen of the skin. The skin becomes less resilient. The collagen cross-links, it loses flexibility. It loses elasticity. It loses the ability to resist shear and pressure. And we add that to all the pressures and the shear that goes on with walking, you set up a cascade where ulcers are not only common, they're almost inevitable. Take all this in combination with what we've learned so far. Decreasing retopes, decreasing number of capillaries that are interfacing, so you get decreased nutrients, and the crossing of collagen in the skin, ulcers are going to be a very difficult thing to limit in these patients. Well, I mentioned that in this previous slide, that collagen cross-linking is increased with hyperglycemia, and so is oxidation, glycosylation of collagen. So how do you tie that in with the aging of skin? Well, the Maillard reaction is looks at advanced glycosylated end products. And in this particular study, and there's been other ones, this was done by Dunn a number of years ago, but other ones have repeated it. They looked at early and late stage markers for glycosylation. The early marker was fructolysine. Late stage marker was carboxymethylysine and pentazidine. It doesn't matter what the markers were. What does matter is this, and I think you'll find this fascinating. They found that in diabetic patients, there was a threefold increase in early stage markers of skin age, and a twofold increase in late stage markers of skin age. And they found in this reaction that the increased markers in skin age were correlated not with the chronological years of age of the patient, but correlated directly with the hemoglobin A1Cs. Non-diabetics were having increased end product correlating with age based on chronological age. Diabetic patients was based on the hemoglobin A1C. The message is this. And don't think, by the way, it's just skin. This looked at skin. But you can bet your bottom dollar is all soft tissue systems. It's cardiac, it's the lens of the eye, it's renal, it's all of it. The message is, if you stop the hyperglycemia, you stop the aging process. Now there's hope. A good friend of mine's mother passed away about 3 or 4 years ago. She was 93. Diagnosed at age 11 with diabetes type 1. How did she go to 93? Never lost a leg. Never had a skin ulcer. Somehow, back then, somebody who they went to said, eat four or five, six meals a day and keep your blood sugars low. Low, low, low. And she was tight as can be. When I was in school, we used to take patients to surgery and say, keep them sweet. You don't want them to get a hyperglycemic shock. Keep them sweet. Keep them up a little high. They were doing the opposite. 93, no effects. And she watched her sugar like a hawk. Hyperglycemia. Control it, and there's hope. Diabetes accelerates the chemical aging of long-lived tissue proteins. This is all these soft tissue systems. So here you see the effects of diabetes, or aging for that matter, and the effects of crossing of collagen. This is a beautifully computerized, enhanced photograph of this woman, who's advanced in years by 15 years, and you can see that as the collagen cross-links, it loses resistance against gravity because it loses resilience, elasticity, and the skin sags, and we get creases because we lose the ability for the skin to maintain its structural integrity by the crossing of collagen. In that same manner, the foot and the other tissue systems that we talked about, the plantar aspect of the foot, other areas of the skin, other tissue systems are similarly affected. Transepidermal water loss. The average individual who's healthy can lose as much as 2 to 5 grams of water per square centimeter per hour. That is a lot of water. That's a lot of water. And when you add to that ulcer in the skin, it's a chimney. It evaporates right through that. Like a, there's nothing blocking it. And you dehydrate even faster. So dehydration is a major problem. This is a pictorial, which is somewhat overly stated, but it drives home the point well enough. This is Nermontak skin in this representation. Here's a bar soap applied. The bar soap could be ivory, could be zest, whatever your preference would be. Removes the lipid material, and you lose the mortar, and you lose, therefore, the ability to maintain a skin barrier. You dehydrate, but you also let bacteria and fungi in. This is an example of the high pH. Remember, normal pH is about 5.5 of skin. Look how high the pH is here. Most dermatologists would say if you're using a bar soap, Dove is what they say, it's about 7.5 to 8 in this pH value, but still way too high. And so we look at skin cleansers now as first, second, and third generation. The third generation are the newer ones. These are these phospholipids. They are pH balanced. They are based on vegetable oils rather than other oils because vegetable oils will allow skin to breathe. Petroleum oil will block skin respiration, stop skin from breathing. Vegetable oils do not do that. And they have other aspects involved too. But pH and vegetable oil balance are the two big things you should look at. And they're all over the grocery stores. They're in a bottle. You squeeze them instead of a bar soap. They're not good for your diabetic patients. They're good for all of us, too. They allow our skin to maintain lipid material needs to protect us against dehydration and us against also bacteria and other objects in the environment. Skin breathes. In fact, it's been shown that the upper two layers, the epidermis and the stratum corneum, all of that goes through breathes and gets oxygen through the environment. Not through the dermal epidermal junction. So if you apply petrolatum, which is any mineral product, such as any ointment, all ointments are petrolatum. It doesn't mean never use them, but it means understand you stop normal skin respiration. And it's better not to do that. You're better using a cream base, if you could, or something else, or a vegetable-based oil, which will allow skin respiration, just because it goes through its normal oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange mechanism. Amino acid replacement is extremely important, and the study of corneal therapeutics is the science of applying topical agents to improve skin health and decrease aging. Now, we all see the cosmetology ads all over the place. Beverly Hills, I was in Munich just a week ago, and there's big fancy dermatological stores there, 200 big fancy malls, and they're all dealing with what? Stopping the aging process. You know, we need, as physicians, to get somewhat off our pedestals and not be so narrow and a little broader, I think, to look at some of our colleagues, because there's something to this cosmetology thing. It's called corneotherapeutics, and there are people who have spent years and years studying skin and trying to stop the aging of that process. And most of this is based on something called the Fofrin and Dalton rule. Now, we don't know about it, but dermatologists do and cosmetologists do. It's been around for probably some 25, 30 years. It simply pertains to the following. Any topical agent applied to skin that has a molecular weight of less than 500 Daltons will pass through normal skin. So the goal in all of this science is to find things that improve skin health that have a molecular weight of below 500 is the number, 500 Dalton, below 500 Dalton, and that will pass through normal skin. And the carrier agent to be above that. So, all proteins are important for skin structure. Collagen, other aspects, they're all built with amino acids. All amino acids, all of them, can pass through Nermontak skin. All vitamins can pass through Nermontak skin. So, there are many that we could talk about. the ones we'll talk about today, because of timing, we'll narrow it down to four. Glycine and proline collectively make up over 50% of the structure of collagen. Collagen is the basis from which skin is formed. I mean, you know, look at what's an ulcer? An ulcer is a hole in the skin, right? So how's that heal? You have this hole. First thing that has to happen is collagen's got to form and transverse the hole from one side to the other to build a scaffold. Once the scaffold is filled and formed, angiogenesis can occur. Blood vessels traverse the scaffold and you get now vasculature, and now you have a healthy nutrient base, and skin cells can migrate from the periphery toward the center and close the wound. But you need collagen. We all know that wounds have a phasic problem. They're stuck in the inflammatory phase of wound healing. We all know that. They cannot go into the proliferative phase. I like to call the proliferative phase the phase of fibroplasia, because I think it's more connecting with the reality, meaning that they can't form collagen. So all we're trying to do is get wounds from the chronic to the acute stage, meaning what? They form collagen again, and the wound can start a healing process. So proline and glycine are extremely important in the periphery and applied to the area, can easily be applied. Cysteine is an important sequester of nitric acid. It removes tumor necrosis factor. It's a potent antioxidant, and taurine, which reduces as we get older. We should all be taking some taurine as a supplement, in fact, because taurine as we get older is reduced. And taurine is a very important intracellular oxidant, the interstitial fluid. So when you look at topical agents and you look at skin health, some basics to look at that you may want to have in your topical applications. Vitamin A, as we all know, regulates keratinocyte differentiation and skin proliferation. Vitamin D3 activates A. And without it, you get no appropriate. So vitamin D3 synthesis is important, and this also decreases with age. It's interesting. You all see milk, right? Fortified with vitamin D. Look at it. Most of the milks are fortified with vitamin D2, not D3. D2 does nothing. It's worthless. Shouldn't be allowed to be advertised. D3 is what you need. D3 activates A. D2 is trash can stuff, but that's what they put milk. That's what they do with milk. It's cheap. Vitamin D, we all know, it's been shown for many years to decrease disease such as rickets, but for us today, decreased vitamin D has been shown to have increased risk factors for diabetes 1 and 2. I just had my vitamin D level checked. I'm low. You may be low too. Vitamin D, as we mature, we lose vitamin D capacity. We should also be doing that. Also, too, we're not getting sun exposure anymore. We put some blocks on. We're covering ourselves. So you need some supplementation. B3 and B6 are amino acid cofactors that are involved in building proteins. You cannot build proteins without B3 and B6. So important as well. Vitamin C, we talked about the other night at the table. Somebody asked about vitamin C. Yes, it's an important antioxidant. It is a greater of excessive nitric oxide degradation. We all need nitric oxide. Too much is bad. Not enough is also bad. So help maintain appropriate balance. And vitamin E is not something that we apply to peripheral wound, because vitamin D is used to break down collagen. Vitamin E will break down scar tissue. It breaks down keloids. So it's something that would not be used in a peri wound situation. And we'll talk a little bit about oxidative stress and then go on to some closing remarks. Oxidative stress is a normal part of living. We all talk about oxidative stress and developing free radicals with excessive skin exposure, skin cancers. We talk about air pollution, different environments, aspects of our water that all lead to carcinogenic changes because of free radical production. But free radical production is also part of normal aging. Mitochondria, which is the energy aspect of the cell, produce free radicals every day. Inflammation. Any inflammation produces free radicals. If you have a sore throat, you have free radical production. You cut your hand and you have a cut, it's healed. You get, again, inflammation, free radical production. It's a part of normal living. And therefore, some of it's got to be there, but it's got to be balanced. When free radicals become too high, When these electrons become wild, they can affect other cells and create DNA changes in mitosis, and then we get disease. So you need free radical absorption. You need free radical reduction. The strongest antioxidant known today in the world is hydroxytyrosol. Hydroxytyrosol comes from green olives. Very, very simple. With your dinner tonight, instead of butter, do like the Mediterraneans do. Get some garlic, put some olive oil, dip the bread in that. It's wonderful. And it's very strong oxidative reaction capacity. Let's look at that. This is the ORAC. ORAC is the only worldwide accepted scale that measures the ability of a substance to reduce free radical production. Red wine too is great, right? Here's red wine. Grapeseed extract, real big in nutritional stores. Here's grapeseed extract. So this is hydroxytyrosol. Ounce per ounce by volume, these fill in magnitudes compared to hydroxytyrosol. So a couple tablespoons of olive oil each day, not only good for you, a strong antioxidant to protect you against all of these chronic diseases, all of them. So use skin topicals with vegetable oils, not with mineral oil. All mineral oil, all of it is paraffin. All of it is a petroleum base. All of it blocks epidermal respiration. And then just a closing remark, and I'll have one more point which I wanted to add. I always love adding this little point because I think it's sort of fun. And then some closing remarks. Essential fatty acids are important. We all need them. And we all know omega-3 is important. But omega-6 we're not very well aware of. Omega-6 we need more attention, I think, given to. The normal healthy ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 oils, and remember, they're both essential fatty acids. You have to ingest some of this stuff. It's not being produced enough. So the normal ratio should be about 1-to-1 in your diet. In the Orient, it's about 4-to-1. In Western societies, it's about 15-to-16-to-1. So where does all this come from? 2 years ago, almost to date, 2 years ago, I was in New York in November, and the front page of the New York Times had two interesting articles that caught my attention. One of them was an article that talked about the longevity. And it stated that the longest living subset of humans, at least as of 2 years ago, were Oriental women living in the Orient on Oriental diet. They were most disease-free and had the longest longevity. The same page in that same front page of that same New York Times also had a report on restaurants in New York. And it was sort of funny. They were stating that 35% of the restaurants that said they had wild salmon, in fact, were not wild. They didn't even know it. They cited many reasons, but one that struck my mind, and I remember, was that the term wild king salmon has become almost a term like Pepsi or Coke. Wild king salmon doesn't mean it's wild. It means that's the kind of salmon it is. And so they say if they're wild king salmon, everybody thinks it's wild, and they put that on the menu. Now, what does that mean? Well, here's what that means. Atlantic salmon at that time, and somewhat changing since then, there's been somewhat in the news, but not enough. Atlantic salmon, for the most part, 90% at least, is farm-raised. Even the European cultures, the Netherlands, farm-raised. I wasn't aware of that until I was over there last year. Farm-raised salmon, what they often do is they feed the fish diet dead fish. And therefore, the protein's breaking down and becomes very high in omega-6 oils, not omega-3s. Wild salmon doesn't have that problem. It has omega-3s. Omega-3 is what you want. Omega-6, if you remember back to your biochemistry, is a prodromal for arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is the beginning of the chain for inflammation. All inflammatory processes are enhanced by omega-6. Omega-6 pushes multiple cancers. It pushes coronary disease, vascular disease, pushes all of these chronic diseases because it pushes the inflammatory process involved with them. So you get some basic studies. Here you see a study in which they reduced the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio down to 4-1, decreased cardiovascular disease risk in this one study by 70%. Another study, they reduced about 2-3-1, had a significant reduction in inflammation in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Cellular proliferation, colorectal cancer was decreased to the ratio of 2.5-1, but 4-1 did not decrease it. So now they have to find, the point is you don't want a lot of omega-6 oils. So avoid omega-6, push omega-3s, don't eat farmed salmon. Now they got this new thing called natural farming. What's natural farming? It's better. They don't feed the dead fish. They're in these large pens. They're maybe acres around. They're caged. So they're swimming there. And probably the omega-6 ratio is probably a lot better. So for your own health, not just diabetics, wild salmon. And Pacific salmon, the Pacific Rim is all wild. There's no farming up there. No farming in Alaska as well. So for whatever that's worth. Coming back to the main topic on a couple concluding remarks, let me sum it up with this, and I think we'll be right on time. Nourished skin, I believe, will decrease aging and should decrease ulcer risk and provide better wound closure. I can't prove that. It's my perspective, but I think it makes sense. And I think we need to look more at what they've done with cardiovascular disease and mirror that with wound care. That is, not just look at the hole, which is the myocardial infarct on their side, or the ulcer on our side. Not just look at the prairie wound, but look at the skin as an organ. What makes it healthy or unhealthy, and try to drive directives and nutrition that go toward that end. In that regard, maintain general hydration. We're all dehydrated. We all have an inability to fight chronic diseases, if for no other reason for that. Skin cleansing with phospholipids. Try to avoid bar soaps wherever you can, especially in diabetic patients, because these patients are prone to ulcerations and infections. And oftentimes, the ulcer leads to the infection, but other times it's the other way around. A folliculitis can also lead to an ulcer. So it's important. The 500 Dalton rule. Remember that anything under 500 Daltons will pass through skin, and the essential vitamins that come from Iowa and McCord Research that you want to look on all your products are A, D, B3, B6, and C. Other ones are fine. If you're in the prairie wound tissue or around the wound, you don't want E. A lot of these products, by the way, will have E. They'll say for general health, if it has E, you probably don't want to use it. Antioxidants. Remember hydroxytyrosol is intercellular antioxidation. Intercellular antioxidation. Extremely important. Because if the cell is protected internally against oxidative stress, that means mitochondria can't be changed by free radicals, DNA remains intact, etc. Somewhat, but almost as important, is interstitial oxidative stress reduction, and one of the most potent amino acids in that regard is taurine. Remember that all of us decrease taurine as we mature, so taurine to some extent should be replaced, and amino acids, glycine, alpha-proline, cysteine, and taurine. Remember the pictures of the retopagues, those projections of the dermal-epidermal junction, and how important that is to increase surface area and to allow good things to come in and bad things to go out. And remember that that is lost. It's flattened with aging, and that skin aging is accelerated with diabetes. Figure that 15 years is a good general loop. Capillary loops are also decreased through that Maillard reaction. We showed that. And new technologies to assess skin and skin health are on the rise in the future. There are many, many fascinating skin things to look at that I like even today in our clinic at Temple University, and many more things to come, I'm sure, in the future. With that, I do want to thank McCord Research for allowing me the opportunity to have this information for you. Darlene McCord, my good friend, and I want to thank all of you for your attention this afternoon. It's really been a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed the lecture and took something back home for you, your families, and your patients. Thank you very much.